This season of On the Contrary is supported by Edelgive Foundation, an organization that works to support the growth of small to mid-sized nonprofits working at the grassroots in India. Edelgive's mission is to transform communities by enabling leaders, organizations, and the ecosystem of philanthropy as a whole. Over the last decade, the institution has invested billions of rupees in the Indian development sector and has been leading collaborative action towards building an independent, resilient civil society.
So mitigation, adaptation, resilience, three things must guide our policy at the ground level as much as what we are trying to do at the global level to try and get cooperative action. We need a global action because you can't get mitigation unilaterally by one country. You have to get countries to agree.
If a drought hits in 1 year, a farmer would have enough food, grains and savings to tide over that drought. But the problem of climate change, of course, is that extreme events could become more frequent, they could become more intense. And if they recur in consecutive years, then the usual coping strategies fail. So what we lack in our country is strong safety nets and insurance.
Hi, I'm Rachita Vora, and you're listening to On the Contrary by India Development Review, or IDR, a show featuring unlikely conversations on topics that affect our future. On this podcast, hear differing perspectives from leaders and experts as they help us make sense of the most pressing issues of our time. Your host for the show is Arun Myra, a thought leader who has the unusual combination of having worked in the private sector, the social sector, as well as the government, where he was a member of India's Planning Commission. Here's your host, Arun Myra.
All of us are feeling the effects of climate change to some degree. And many of us, no matter where in the world we may be, experience these effects daily. Heat waves, drought, unseasonal rains and cyclones, extreme weather events. Marginalized communities in particular, and women especially, face these effects disproportionately. The recent UN report by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change has warned that carbon dioxide levels were greater in 2019 than they had been in at least 2 million years, and that humans are to blame. We need to do more and do better now. We no longer have the luxury of waiting. As experts, scientists, and climate activists from across the world were preparing to travel to Glasgow for COP26, I sat down with Nitin Desai and Ulka Kelkar to talk about the climate action strategies that India needs and how we can involve the people in policy and decision-making that affects their lives. Nitin has worked on national and global climate policy for many decades. He was the senior advisor and key draftsman for Our Common Future, the landmark report of the Brundtland Commission on Environment and Development by the United Nations. He was also an integral part of the Rio Earth Summit and the Commission on Sustainable Development and has advised the Indian government on climate policy. Ulka is the director of the Climate Program at World Resources Institute. An economist by training, she has worked as a research fellow with both TERI and the environmental think tank ATRI. Through her work, she has studied rural communities and has also devised business models for low-cost, climate-resilient housing in disaster-prone regions of Bangladesh and Nepal. Thank you both for being here together to have a conversation about this very crucial topic.
Thank you, Mr. Myra.
Thank you, Arun. Thank you.
Ulka, coming to you first. You've been working in the climate action space in India for a while. You've also worked with a lot of communities on the ground. Could you tell us what you've come across in the field? How is climate change affecting marginalized communities?
I thought I'd share examples from my field work in Maharashtra and Karnataka. And when we go to the field, we find that we don't need to tell farmers about climate change. They already know about climate change. They may not attribute it to global atmospheric processes, but they certainly do understand the role of deforestation or building up on, say, common open pasture lands. farmers are familiar in our country with climate disasters and extreme events. In some sense, if a drought hits in 1 year, a farmer would have enough food, grains and savings to tide over that drought. But the problem of climate change, of course, is that extreme events could become more frequent, they could become more intense. And if they recur in consecutive years, then the usual coping strategies fail. So what we lack in our country is strong safety nets and insurance. The second point I wanted to make was really that seldom are gender considerations taken into account in making decisions around climate change, adaptation or mitigation. Mitigation means reducing greenhouse gas emissions at source, while adaptation would refer to actions that would help us cope with the impacts of climate change, that is, temperature rise or rainfall change or other extreme events. So, for example, we don't often consider that if you're introducing an adaptation strategy that involves more animal husbandry, for example, or different agricultural practices, how will that impact women's work burden? Or have they been adequately trained to carry those out? Even on the mitigation side, fieldwork from Karnataka has shown, this is that of a colleague, Bhargavi Rao, who's found that when deals were made about selling land for solar parks, these were made by men in liquor shops without consulting women. So often household adaptation to climate change considers only part of the family. And finally, the point I wanted to make here is that in our country, cost is still a very major factor when it comes to making any kind of adjustment, but it's not the only factor. My fieldwork in a small emerging town called Ramnagara showed that often people switch to, say, solar water heaters when they're building a new house and moving into the city and have this aspiration of a modern, clean energy lifestyle. So we do need both regulatory policies as well as market-based policies when it comes to climate change. And we need to give a lot of attention to the kinds of options that are there in cities, like rooftop solar photovoltaic, rather than large-scale utility solar parks, utility-scale solar parks.
Speaking of regulatory policies, Nitin, I want to ask you about what the focus has been at the global level and where you think we should be focusing.
But essentially, from the climate perspective, the focus at the global level has been largely on mitigation. How do I reduce accumulation of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere and thus reduce the risk of large-scale temperature changes? Now, the reality is that what we are going to face cannot be addressed only by mitigation. You mentioned adaptation. When you stay within 1.52 degrees, you are going to get certain significant changes in ecosystems. And you'll have to learn how to adapt to them and cope with them. And there's one more point I want to add, besides mitigation and adaptation, and that is resilience. You can say there'll be more floods. You can say there'll be more droughts, more periods of 48 to 50 degree temperature, but you cannot see when. So you need resilience in the sense of how to cope with this emergency when it arises. People at the ground level are more aware. One of the NGOs I've been working with did a study of how people saw climate. This was done in the hill areas of UP. The important thing is what people are worried about is not temperature increase, but climate instability. And something one farmer said there, he says, "Main abhi mausam padh nahi sakta hun. I cannot read the weather." He was used to his traditional approach. If the sky is red there, it means this is going to happen. He says, this doesn't happen. And then people gave examples. Oh, that bird used to come here only in such and such month. Now it comes in such and such month. This spring used to dry up only in June. Now it is drying up in March. So the examples they gave are actually very practical and down to earth. In my view, if you start working with people at the ground level and connect managing climate risk at the ground level with other things that you're trying to do for their livelihoods, for sustainable livelihoods, I think you'll make a very great impact. And we are not doing that. So mitigation, adaptation, resilience. Three things must guide our policy at the ground level as much as what we are trying to do at the global level to try and get cooperative action. We need a global action because you can't get mitigation unilaterally by one country. You have to get countries to agree. And incidentally, I don't think the West is doing anything particularly great. In fact, they are failed almost always on the commitments they have made. They failed the commitments they made at Rio. They failed in the commitments they made under the Kyoto Protocol. And I have no doubt that they are likely to fail on the commitments they're making for 2030. The reality is that the people who are really trying to address this because they're facing this are really in the developing countries.
At this point, we'll take a small break and we'll hear more from our guests on the other side.
See, in the beginning, there was no language. Mm-hmm. We know that we are the scavengers. Mm. And why we are scavengers, we don't know. Mm. And who said we are scavengers, we don't know. There were many problems we faced in the beginning. Mm-hmm. We don't know that what to talk about. Now we are clear. Mm. We are talking about the liberation. Mm-hmm. We are talking about the rehabilitation. Mm. We are talking about the elimination. Mm. These are the words we are brought later stages.
That's Bezwada Wilson, a lifelong crusader against manual scavenging and the systemic discrimination that it perpetrates against Dalits in India. Bezwada was born into a Dalit family of manual scavengers, and he channeled his outrage into building a grassroots movement to liberate his community from this practice. In 2016, he was awarded the Ramon Magsaysay Award for his efforts. You can learn more about his life's work on IDR Interviews, a special feature that shines a spotlight on social change leaders and their efforts to shift the status quo in the country. Check it out on www.idronline.org. And now, back to Arun Myra.
So, there's an element of power dynamics here. The people that have the most influence in climate policy making are often not the ones who experience the effects of climate change most acutely. Your example of the West versus developing countries is a case in point. What we need is a systems approach. And the problem I find is that experts think that local communities don't know much or that they aren't well informed. So how can we change this? How can we change the power equation between the people on the ground, the experts and government who operate at a very high level? What do you suggest, Ulka?
Complicated question. I think there are many things that researchers, experts can do, and then there are some things that can be done on the government side as well. So I think there is definitely greater moves towards using systems thinking in approaching this problem. For example, we could build a systems dynamics model that look at the energy aspects and the economy aspects in the same model so that you could actually tell that low carbon mitigation actions could have positive effects on the GDP or could create new jobs or could improve health. All of these things could be studied within the same model. The second trend in research is that of doing transdisciplinary research, where even at the problem phase itself, just deciding which question to even study, you involve the community, the affected community, and don't presume to even know the question, let alone the way to explore the answer. But I think researchers or experts also owe it to demystify climate change and to avoid, you know, using jargon where it is not required. I think we need much more regional media coverage in regional languages, which, for example, happened during this latest IPCC report launch. But I think there is also something to be said for disciplinary depth. We just need to learn to work together. But the years of investment in understanding a particular system from a particular disciplinary perspective can add depth and understanding, which just needs to be harnessed along with whether it is people who implement policies, you know, people in government, or whether it is the communities who are, you know, affected. I think it's also very important to build capacity in the government, especially if you think of it, say, as a city scale, where all of these different sectors and technical interventions all come to play in this geography of a city. And here, I think we again have this problem of disciplinary fragmentation. That is, you may have urban planners who approach the problem in a certain way, but they may not have the ecological sensitivity to understand how to marry the two together, the ecological concerns and the urban planning concerns. So there we need to build capacity even within municipal agencies, and that's something which is definitely lacking. And to make it institutionally possible for people from different jurisdictional mandates to not worry about stepping on each other's toes, but to be able to actually work together and solve this problem in the systems approach.
Let me put in a slight qualification here. We cannot wait for communities to react after the event happens. We need them to start doing things in advance. Mm-hmm. And this is why you need this science. You need this forward-looking thing. Because today we are asking people on climate to take action decades before the effects will be seen. Communities are important, like the communities who cope with the Kosi floods. But we are made aware of the fact that 20, 30 years from now, this is what's likely to happen, which is very different from what it is now. So do not go to the extreme of saying, leave it to communities to adjust, because we can't wait. Because communities are good at adjusting when things happen, but they cannot necessarily be able to anticipate what's likely to happen. I would say the greatest contribution of science has been raising this awareness and getting governments to at least take action 40, 50 years before something is likely to happen. Now, that's not a bad thing, that awareness raising. When we did the Brundtland report, the awareness of climate change was virtually limited to meteorological scientists. Then it slowly started expanding. And this is why we need science to provide that framework, not necessarily all the answers, because we don't know the answers. I don't know the answers for the long run on what we can do to cope with some of these. There's another reason why I think local communities do matter. You're going to see a profound change in the world energy economy. By 2050, the world which does not use coal and petroleum is going to be a radical transformation of the global energy economy. Today, you have an energy economy heavily dependent on a few countries. 20% of world trade is in energy products. That will disappear. The case for centralization of energy supply, etc., within countries will become very limited. And it is all right. You have centralized grids and large capacity thermal generating stations and so on. But if I move over to an energy system which is radically different and relies much more on free energy, which is wind and solar, it's not energy which anybody owns. Nobody owns wind and nobody owns solar. Then you're going to get a very, very different type of economic and structural impact. So I agree with decentralization, but I do not accept the idea that the scientists are misleading us. No, they have raised awareness and they are telling us what is likely to happen 40, 30, 40, 50 years from now, which is very important.
So I think Mr. Desai said a very nice thing. He said nobody owns wind and solar, right? So it's free energy. Unfortunately, though, people own the land on which wind and solar farms are set up. And that's where, you know, things like these power differentials and decision making comes into the picture. And some of the examples that I gave earlier were basically meant to illustrate that. We do have processes in place for community participation, for community rights to land, and we do definitely need to recognize that the land is serving multiple goals. Even within climate change itself, the same land is required to grow nutritious food, we're required to harvest rainwater, we're required to sequester carbon in trees, grasslands, and mangroves, and also support livelihoods such as pastoralists or even landless laborers who don't have legal rights to the land but are profoundly impacted by any decisions that are made around it. So definitely, it's a very complex issue. We cannot assume that renewable energy is benign. We cannot assume that all climate actions are going to be good in every respect. So we'll have to go back to the roots of India's decentralized decision-making and participatory processes under the 73rd and 74th Amendment of the Constitution and really empower those. And as I mentioned, make it possible even for local governance agencies to do that decision-making in a way that marries the ecological considerations with the developmental considerations. But I'll give you two examples of why I believe that this is possible and something where climate action can have positive developmental benefits. And the two examples I wanted to give were that of rural hospitals, where, for example, in Jharkhand, during the COVID, hospitals that were able to install solar power were able to run ventilators on the solar power and were able to save the money that otherwise they would have had to pay for diesel gensets. And the second is our work in just one district in Madhya Pradesh, Sidhi district, shows that we could sequester 7 million tons of carbon by investing in tree-based restoration and generate 30,000 jobs for 3,000 micro-enterprises around things like bamboo or jackfruit or amla. So I do believe that, you know, climate action can have a positive impact. Even our macroeconomic models show that. The problem, of course, is in the details. That is, when you see gains and losses happening in different states of India or between men and women, or that there is a lack or there is a gap in terms of the skills required to access the new green jobs or the finance required to set up new green enterprises. That's where I think we need to also focus our attention going forward, especially as we scale up with this energy revolution.
What you're talking about is the interconnectedness between issues. Climate action is not only about climate, it's about land, people, health, livelihoods, and so much more. So I want to bring in something Nitin said earlier about how the narrative needs to change more towards sustainable livelihoods. And Nitin, can you elaborate?
Let me say this, that today the actions that we are seeing on climate are actions which are basically being driven either by philanthropists or by regulatory pressures. Actions which are positive for climate are still not built into a normal system of incentives, etc., that exists, except in a few areas like renewable energy, which now no longer requires heavy support from philanthropists or government and is becoming profitable. So let us be realistic. We will find examples, but it's going to take a lot of work to get to a point where it becomes normal rather than just something which is being promoted by some well-meaning person somewhere. Why just focus on sustainable livelihoods? You know, when we were writing the Brundtland report, I suggested at one stage that the term sustainable development should be changed to responsible development. That was rejected by the members, saying that no, that's too political. Let's stick to sustainable development. Second, even there, you'll see parts of Brundtland and you'll see more of it in the Rio thing. We argued that you can't separate environmental management from poverty and livelihoods. And you will not be able to protect our environment if you are not addressing issues of people's living, of people's poverty, of people's deprivation. Equally, you cannot address that problem unless you address land, water, conservation, and issues of that nature. That's where the notion of sustainable livelihoods came. This is being promoted very actively by the Foundation for Ecological Security in its work. They started as a conservation organization, but they realized that you can't conserve unless you worry about people. I'll give you one very interesting example. A friend of mine who made a lot of money and was very keen on tigers. So he said, I want to protect tigers. So he started giving money for tiger protection, you know, jeeps, etc., etc. Then he discovered that that was not enough. You can't protect tigers unless you protect forests. So he expanded his philanthropy to include forests, not just wildlife conservation. And then he discovered that you can't protect forests unless you worry about the people who live in and around forests. So today, more and more of his money is going into supporting the people who live in and around forests. Now, this is an example of if you really think through carefully, you will realize that you will not be able to do even a limited thing like protecting tigers unless you worry about livelihoods. One final point, if you permit me. One of the fears I have is that climate may become too much of a driving force for things. We must have a broader vision. Take forests. I shudder to think if now we design forest policy to maximize carbon sequestration. Forests serve much more than carbon sequestration in terms of land and water conservation and many other ecosystem services. So we must integrate the idea of climate protection with a broader vision of sustainability. One of my fears is that, particularly in the case of forests, that we may move over into something which, अच्छा ठीक है, ये बहुत जल्दी से उगता है, तो बहुत जल्दी से carbon sequestration होगा, ये plant करो. That's not the answer. The answer is to combine this with biodiversity, with ecosystem protection, with wildlife protection, with forests, with water and soil conservation, and so on. So I'd say that, though I've been arguing for climate for so long, I would urge that it be placed in a broader context. This is where your system approach becomes important.
This brings me to my next question, which is about this broader context that Nitin is talking about. How do we normalize some of this thinking so that we make better choices today for our future?
I mean, in climate change, we talk about technological solutions, we talk about behavioral solutions at an individual level, but the social change is something which is the most difficult of all. So I won't pretend to have any answers to this. But just responding, or rather reflecting on what Mr. Desai said, I think resilience, whether it is of women or of families or of communities, it is very much limited by larger driving forces. And we are limiting the set of choices that are available. So, for example, taking the example of water, if there's pollution upstream or if there are embankments downstream, then what can one village, which is, you know, exposed to floods, do? There are limits to what can be done within the purview of that particular community or that particular village. So we should think a little bit, you know, expand that thinking of a system and think of solutions upstream and downstream as well. But I wanted to give two examples of possible ways by which to make the systems change happen. And one example is from the corporate sector, which is that of carbon pricing. So when carbon or other pollution is emitted when we burn fossil fuels, nobody is penalized for that pollution. There is no price for emitting carbon dioxide. It's a waste that we don't consider. One way to include the external costs of that pollution is by factoring in a special price for it. So until there is a price on carbon pollution, it won't factor in into any kind of decision making that a company makes about where to, what kind of electricity to buy, or how to dispose of its waste, or what kind of inputs to use. But the moment that there is a price put on carbon, voluntarily, internally, it enters into the investment decisions or the commercial decisions of any company. And you'd be surprised to know that there are more than 50 Indian companies, large Indian companies, that have voluntarily adopted a price on carbon without the government having to tell them to do so. The second example I want to give is that of cities. Even though climate policy in India is always, you know, the purview of the central government, specifically the Ministry of Environment, Forest and Climate Change, a lot of Indian cities are making moves towards low carbon development pathways. So they know that the bulk of their emissions in the future are going to come from infrastructure that has not yet been constructed. Buildings that have not been built, cars that are not yet on the roads, appliances that have not yet been bought. We can make choices now so that a couple of decades down the line, we are saved from making more painful choices. So I think there are both regulatory windows of opportunity as well as market-based instruments that can lead to more sensible choices. And the bottom line really is that of genuine opportunities for participation, so that we're not restricting the set of choices that are available to communities and forcing them to be more resilient than they're capable of being.
Nitin, I'm going to give you the last word. What are the key areas where India should focus going forward?
Essentially, I would argue that do not underestimate the importance of awareness. She mentioned that 50 Indian companies have started doing internal carbon pricing. When I started, there was not even one. So let us also understand that there is a growing awareness. In fact, I find that there's greater awareness now in the corporate sector, greater willingness to look at it, partly because of global pressures. Today, you try and get funding for fossil fuels internationally, it'll be very difficult. The area we should understand best is the uncertainty. We still don't know enough. And I think one area of emphasis in India, we start collecting much more information on local environmental conditions, and not just in an isolated way, but in a broad way. She correctly mentioned there's no point in saying a village will look after water if the water basin is being managed by somebody else. So in fact, this is incidentally one of the worst areas in India. The failure of management of water. We do not have water basin management anywhere in India because there are so many interstate rivers. We have very little information on groundwater aquifers. They've just started collecting information now on groundwater aquifers. And basically local arrangements for water management like village committees and so on have been destroyed. This is the one of the weakest areas. And I would end by saying that if I had to identify one immediate area where the government can do something, it is in the management of water resources in a coherent and sensible sort of way. Beyond that, keep fighting at the global level.
Thank you both once again for being a part of this very important discussion. What I am taking back from it, Nitin and Ulka, is that in order to effectively address climate change, we need to have a broader vision. One that takes into account related factors such as water, livelihoods, agriculture, and so many others. And there are roles for all of us to play at a regulatory level, at a market level, and at an individual level. Finally, we need an approach that balances scientific expertise with people's expertise about their own lives. This is the only way we will ensure that our decisions are inclusive and our climate actions equitable.
On the Contrary is produced by Shreya Adhikari, Smanita Shetty, and me, Rachita Vora. This episode was hosted by Arun Myra for IDR. Production by Made in India. IDR is an online journal that publishes cutting-edge ideas, lessons, and insights written by and for the people working on some of India's toughest problems. You can check us out at idronline.org or find us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, or LinkedIn. If you like our show, please do subscribe and leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts so more people can find out about us. You can also email us on write to us@idronline.org. Thank you for listening and see you next week.